To say hydrogen's day has been coming for a long time is an understatement. It was discovered by Henry Cavendish in 1766, and it was quickly identified as the most abundant chemical substance in the universe, the entire universe. In other words, there is no peak hydrogen. We can use the stuff forever, and we can use it to store energy and to fuel transportation. And maybe, just maybe, today is the day that hydrogen takes center stage as the fuel of choice. In transportation, the electrification of heavy vehicles and service vehicles like taxis and police cars and delivery vans just isn't practical using battery power. The practical alternative is hydrogen. Practical in so many ways, such as storage capacity in the vehicle, the fact that hydrogen and gas mix. Heck, hydrogen and methane mix, and so does hydrogen and diesel. And the sources of hydrogen are ubiquitous. They are everywhere. That said, in a world that is endeavoring to lower GHGs, green hydrogen is treasured. That means the electricity used to produce the hydrogen is, well, it's green. Well, what about waste byproduct hydrogen? The hydrogen you can produce using landfill waste. Not only do you reduce methane emissions from landfills, but you also are creating clean burning hydrogen. And get this, there is more than one source of waste hydrogen. It's an exciting new world. But wait, of course there's a challenge, and that's the challenge of switching vehicles from diesel or gas to hydrogen. And that can be costly, and who do you turn to, and how does it work? Thankfully, enter BC-based Hydra Energy that offers hydrogen to trucking fleets as a service, HAAS, hydrogen as a service. I invited Jessica Verhagen, the CEO of Hydra Energy, to join me for a conversation that matters about hydrogen's role in a low carbon world. Jessica, thank you for joining me here on Conversations That Matter. It really is an exciting day for hydrogen, isn't it? What are some of the most recent advances that make us say it is now practical and possible to move, especially larger fleets, those kinds of vehicles that are in much longer use during the day, onto hydrogen and off of the other carbon-based fuels that we're used to seeing them run on?
Oh, well, thank you, Stu, for having me. I'm really excited to do this interview and talk more about hydrogen after our last guest, Dr. Walter Morita. For us, the exciting developments has really been being able to secure a low-cost source of hydrogen. And that's what prevents a lot of companies from moving forward in previous phases of hydrogen. I've heard recently it called a hydrogen renaissance because it's coming back into the fore again. Not only are there technological developments, but more financial ones as well, where we have ways of capturing, for example, waste hydrogen, as you mentioned, and being able to compress that, clean it up in an economical way and provide it to fleets for less than diesel or on par with diesel. And that's really what allows us to scale, is when we flip that switch from what is something that was previously expensive or perceived to be expensive to something that is on par with, you know, what they're conventionally used to, the incumbent.
So what are the elements in making it practical? Mm-hmm. You talk about the expense, but you also have to make it practical. You're creating the hydrogen, you still have to deliver it to the end user. And in transportation, that would require fueling stations. And are mm-hmm. you able to do that in a way where you can be working with current, gas stations to be able to say, well, come mm-hmm. in and get your hydrogen here too?
It's a good question. There's two components to the cost of distribution. One is you capture the hydrogen as we do from a waste source, you have to still deliver that hydrogen to the fueling station. And if that's more than a couple hundred kilometers, it gets really uneconomic. You have to use tube trailer trucks or you have to build a pipeline, and both of those are expensive options. So you want to have the geographic distance limited. And then you explore where can you either build your own fueling station, probably integrated with diesel in our case, because they're going to fill up on both fuels. We run a blend of hydrogen and diesel together. Or working with existing stations, there's lots of card lock stations where the truck pulls up, they tap their card, it gives them access to the station and they fill up there. So potentially partnering with cardlock stations or other options where you simply add a hydrogen pump, if you will.
Well, I note that you were just granted a financial an award by the provincial government to build a fueling station in northeastern British Columbia. Mm-hmm. Is that what you have to do, literally put a stake in the ground and say, we're now going to start to build out around that so that, you know, users or fleets can start to create a hub and that you can then extend out? Does it have to be that kind of a planned approach?
It's so interesting that you use the word hub, because that's exactly what the Canadian federal strategy proposed back in December, of creating these clusters or hubs around supply, demand, and then the distribution that connects it. So we actually look for supply first, and then we'll put a map of trucking routes on top of supply to make sure that you have the customers to offtake the supply, and then something close together, like we were talking about geographic proximity, to make sure that you can distribute it economically.
I got to get you to hang on for a second while we take a quick commercial break. Mm-hmm. We'll be right back. So if I think about northeastern British Columbia, and I know the volume of heavy truck traffic that is there, because it's coming in and out of that whole, you know, Fort St. John area where there's huge investment in natural gas and the oil and gas sector. Is that where you then say, okay, we're going to put our first, you know, stake in the ground there and then grow out? And was that your thinking?
Yeah, our thinking is actually more around finding the low-cost supply of hydrogen, because then that creates the rest of the economic case. So once we lock in the supply of hydrogen at a point where it intersects well with, as you mentioned, the transportation element, then that is what kind of unlocks the positive economics that make it scalable.
Okay.
So it's like a regional economic model. You're looking for the overlaps, because Hydra's not, we're a startup, we have 9 employees. We're not big enough to build hundreds of stations across the country. In our economic model, we do provide the hydrogen on par or a little bit lower than the cost of diesel. And then we also provide a fueling station, but we can't provide 10 fueling stations for each one of those. So in our business development, we focus on fleets that return back to the base. Again, so they go out, say, 400 or 500 kilometers, and then they come back to base again. That's really our focus right now.
Okay. So where where is this station?
Can't tell you.
What?
It's a secret. just for a little bit longer. We'll be announcing
how
it
soon. How am I going to drive up when I try to fill it up?
Don't worry, it'll be very public soon.
Okay, yeah. But you talk about hydrogen as a service. What do you do then? You say, okay, we put this here.
Yeah.
Still, the vehicle has to be equipped to be able to accept that fuel and to be able to use it. So what's the relationship between you and the fleet that allows them to say, okay, this works for us?
Yeah, we have a proprietary retrofit kit. So a truck would be retrofitted with our kit, which we also supply and pay for, because it's really important to the fleet that they don't put a whole bunch of money into a retrofit. They don't have huge margins, and that doesn't really make sense for them economically. So we do as a service, meaning that they're just paying for the hydrogen fuel like they would have previously paid for the diesel fuel. And then the retrofit involves putting a series of tanks on the back of the cab, and then some piping that goes to the front where there's an air intake, so there's oxygen that's mixing with hydrogen, and then putting it into an engine chamber and mixing it with the diesel. And that is controlled by an engine control unit. So you know when you're driving your car and you have the little computer unit, if your car is on the newer side, it's the same thing with our hydrogen. We have a little hydrogen computer that's telling you how much hydrogen is burning, and there's a series of algorithms that's optimizing the fuel efficiency.
So you're not removing the vehicle's ability to burn diesel or gasoline, rather you're augmenting it. Is that a better way to look at it?
I'd say we're displacing some of the diesel, but not all of the diesel. So it's co-combusting with the diesel. But the advantage of that is similar if with any kind of hybrid car, that you're not going to be worried about range. Like with electric vehicles, you're always worried. You're very precise. I was asking my friend who drives one of those BMW i3s how many kilometers. He knew exactly. He said 260 kilometers.
Right.
And with our solution, let's say in the unfortunate circumstance that you run out of hydrogen, it just flips to running diesel only. And so you don't have a concern about refueling the same way. It doesn't create that range anxiety.
So the benefit to the fleet is that they know for sure that they have reduced the amount of diesel that they're consuming, and in doing so, they are lowering their own carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. What are the other advantages to the fleet?
Good question. There's a cost advantage because they get to go green without actually putting any capital up front. And then in northeastern British Columbia, because it's our first customers, we're adding an early adopter incentive to charge them 5% less than they would have paid for the diesel. And that's important to them. As I said, they're low margin, so if you're able to offer them a 5% discount on something that's one of their biggest costs, the other one is the drivers themselves, then that is a big bonus for them.
What does it also do, and I'm asking this with no awareness of it whatsoever, but does it help to enhance the engine life?
We have done trials up in northeastern British Columbia for 3 years with over 200,000 kilometers on the trucks. So far, we've found equivalent performance to diesel, so we wouldn't be able to yet prove that it's enhanced engine life. What we have found is there's a filter that they use for diesel to filter out particulates and what have you, and that filter you don't have to replace as often. It's a $5,000 thing that you don't have to replace as often anymore. So there's some maintenance costs that we're finding that are declining, but we'd like to gather more data before we conclusively say it's X number of months of extra time that you have before you have to replace that filter.
So at some point, that vehicle is going to run out its life. Mm-hmm. What happens then? Does your equipment stay with that vehicle, or do you take it back and put it into a new vehicle?
It's the latter. So we model our business off of what our customers' needs are, of course. And so most of the customers that we work with or have spoken with, they are leasing the truck for 5 years. So we retrofit it. They have the truck for 5 years. And then it returns to their dealer, and the dealer sells it on to a farmer in Saskatchewan, or the dealer might sell it on as a drayage truck at the port. But those places don't have hydrogen, so they are not yet. Maybe in the future, we all hope that, right? But in the meantime, we'll take the kit off and reinstall it on another vehicle. The lifespan of most of the components of the kit, like the tanks that we were talking about that go in the back of the cab, are 18, 20 years, so you can keep reusing that equipment for quite a long period of time. There are other fleets, buses for example, they will typically own that vehicle for the lifetime. So then we would go with the lifetime of the vehicle. I think 18 years was, I heard one bus fleet mention, the lifetime that they were using the bus for. So our capacity to have the kit last for 18 years would be there. There'd be software upgrades and things like that, but overall, you could stick with it for the whole 18 years.
Right.
But with the fleets that we work with in northeastern BC, you'd be swapping out that kit every 5 years.
So you talk about the source of hydrogen, and yet when I went to your website, I was looking in, and in my introduction, I talked about waste byproduct hydrogen.
Yeah.
And I was talking about from landfills, but you're saying, no, that's not the only source. So what are other sources, and how are you going about sourcing those?
We're looking at byproduct hydrogen via a chemical process. It's a waste product, so it's being vented right now. So our role is to assist the chemical company to monetize that, so make money from something that they weren't before, like another man's waste is someone else's treasure, right?
Right.
And so by doing that, they have something on their balance sheet that they wouldn't have had otherwise in terms of revenue. There are other options for them to monetize, but what we have found is we're able to offer something that's the highest dollar per kilogram for hydrogen that makes it attractive, and we're taking the capital costs on of building out the equipment. So if you think of the chemical plant and the hydrogen coming out of a vent, we capture that, put it into a compressor, compress it, clean it up, and then we distribute it to the trucks that deliver it then to the fueling station. So all that capital is something that Hydro takes on, and that's why it's called hydrogen as a service.
So I find this amazing. Here is what was stacked emission, even though it's going out carbon neutral, it's still an emission. You're saying, okay, it's right there. We don't even have to build the equipment to create the hydrogen. It's already there. We merely have to capture it, clean it up, and then compress it into storage. So how frequently are you going to be able to find sources like that? And is that going to help you to be able to build out your network?
That is an excellent question, because it's very existential. How long can you use that business model for? It's like a low-hanging fruit. It's more like an entry point to get into the market rather than something that'll be around for 10, 15 years. I think right now there's a limited opportunity to go after those low-hanging fruit. And then after that, we need to look beyond byproduct at other potential sources of hydrogen, which you brought up, like from landfills. We were talking just before the interview about some companies that are doing from plastics into hydrogen. So there's different waste products, I think, beyond just the byproduct opportunities at chemical plants that I think would be natural segues for us.
And there may be other producers who might start to produce the hydrogen with the idea that they're supplying, you know, a grid. And so they could be a source for you as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you've touched on what's been announced across Canada and a few big projects. There's one in Alberta, another one in Quebec that have both been announced, I think, in the last 6 to 12 months. And there are production of hydrogen projects that we could potentially buy from. And the difference there in economics for us would just be the ability to get to that price point that's lower or on par with diesel. We don't have to be putting in these huge capital costs for a compressor and all of the other associated infrastructure necessarily if that's already being delivered to us as a final product. But for us, it just comes down to economics, because at the end of the day, we're trying to help the fleets to switch over to something that decarbonizes them as quickly as possible, but as low cost as possible.
So theoretically, it sounds absolutely magnificent. I'm wondering, okay, well, why aren't we doing it like right now? But we're not doing it right now because the transition can be challenging. What are the major hurdles that you have to clear for you to be able to start to build this out in a way that you can say, we're really making a difference? We're not just having little footprint differences. We're actually making a significant difference. Because I think this is what we all want, and especially in a world where, you know, we're being very ambitious about what our goals are in GHG emission reduction. So how do we get from where we are right now with this exciting work that you're doing to where I guess I'm hoping that you will be?
Lots of good questions in that one. I mean, we could have another whole interview on this topic. It's a good question.
Well, you only have 4.5 minutes.
Initially, I think because hydrogen is so popular right now and very much on trend, that everybody has a hydrogen idea. So I think initially part of our challenge was differentiating ourselves from being a whiteboard exercise or idea to showing that we have real traction, real potential pipeline of customers, real hydrogen secured in northeastern British Columbia. And it's just a matter of, and you probably know this better than me, telling your story, saying what you're going to do, and doing what you said you were going to do, and building that credibility up so we have that track record of performance that that the government can believe in when you're working on programs with the government or grants with the government, that investors can believe in to back you up with money. And then they all kind of play off each other. Like you mentioned, getting the LCFS credit award for our fueling station. We also that month got our $15 million equity investment. So it does feel like once one person believes your story, then you have the follow-on benefits of having that credibility boost from one external party validating you.
The complexity of trying to make this work is, you know, dancing around inside my head thinking, holy smokes, there's so many elements. But you happen to know that I had Dr. Walter Merida in, and he's looking at this model of what would a renewable city look like. And he sees the development and delivery of hydrogen as being a vital component to have renewable cities. So using energy to create green hydrogen, but then being able to deliver it out. I'm beginning to see that there could be a marriage of technologies here between what they're doing and what you're doing. And so as we move forward, there has to be these synergies that come together. So I know that you probably can't say, yes, could you introduce me to Dr. Merida, but But this, I think, is important if in British Columbia we are looking for what is that advantage that we can have. Mm-hmm. Because as you continue to do this, you'll start to build out expertise that can then grow not only in your service, but can also be spin-off opportunities for others. Mm-hmm. How important is that, do you think, in our strategy in trying to move to a greener economy?
Well, I think working as a hub or as a network is incredibly important. I mean, we have research projects that are ongoing with UBC on emissions testing, for example, and working on reducing NOx emissions. So the research that's going on at UBC and other institutions and feeding that into the commercial sector and then vice versa, taking the learnings that we have and feeding that back into research, that networking piece is really important. And also, if you think about where Hydro was born in Vancouver, that's not by mistake. We are following the footsteps of Ballard. So where there's a talent pool that has started to develop in Vancouver around hydrogen, and that's growing and growing. Like, you have Loop Energy as well, our neighbor in Burnaby. So you can see now that there's a bit of a hub or a cluster building of talent, of knowledge sharing, and having that geographic proximity to one another allows us to share that more quickly and for those connections to happen more instantaneously.
So it's easy for us to get excited about the progress that we're making here, but how are we doing when we take a look at Europe, for instance? Mm-hmm. You know, Europe seems to have been moving far more aggressively towards a hydrogen economy. Mm-hmm. What can we learn from what they've done?
Well, actually, I think Dr. Murdo touched a bit on having standards internationalized, and that's a really important component. For example, fueling stations need to be built to certain specs for safety reasons, obviously, and others. And Europe has done quite a bit of work on that as well because of the EU standardizing across many, many different countries already. They're quite used to that concept of standardizing EU-wide on these different elements. But additionally, I think they've really poured a lot of funding and policy development and focus on it that Canada has started doing with the launch of their strategy for hydrogen in December. And then earlier this week, Minister Ralston announced the BC-based strategy for hydrogen. So that stake in the sand is really important. And we can build from there the different policy requirements that will enable it to accelerate from here.
Well, I agree with you. I think that the government has to play a very, very important role in ensuring that this nascent sector is given the resources that it needs to be able to build out. And I wish you great success.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in and having this conversation with me.
Yeah, thank you, Stu. Lovely to be here.